Matthew chapter 26, we're going to pick up in our study at verse 65 tonight, but for the sake of context, I want to go back up to verse 57 and read, if you haven't been studying with us. Of course, Jesus has been taken prisoner, his disciples have forsaken him, and we pick up in verse 57 as he is being taken to Caiaphas, the high priest, and he's going to be questioned by the high priest and the Sanhedrin council. Of course, John, in his account, tells us that he was first taken to Annas, the father-in-law of Caiaphas. Matthew does not mention that in his account, but remember, Annas was the high priest before Caiaphas. He still evidently held a lot of political clout and power in the city of Jerusalem at this time, so he was first taken to him and then brought to Caiaphas, who is the high priest at this time, and of course he would be the one over the Sanhedrin council. Verse 57, and reading from the New King James Version, Matthew 26, "And those who had laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance to the high priest's courtyard, and he went in and sat with the servants to see the end. Now the chief priests, the elders, and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. But at last two false witnesses came forward and said, 'This fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days.' And the high priest arose and said to him, 'Do you answer nothing? What is it that these men testify against you?' But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest answered and said to him, 'I adjure you by the living God that you tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God.' Jesus said to him, 'It is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven.'" We spoke about that text that I just read last Lord's Day evening. We'll not take time to go back over it. I just wanted to read it for the sake of the context, because in verse 65, after Jesus has made the statement that he just made, and in verse 64, and that statement was made after the question or the statement that the high priest made when he said, "I adjure you by the living God that you tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." Of course, the high priest would have made that statement or asked that question of him because Jesus had claimed to be the Christ, the long-awaited Messiah. And as a matter of fact, he was hailed as the Messiah just days earlier when he came into the city of Jerusalem on that Sunday, remember, in his triumphant entry into the city of Jerusalem. And so the Messiah of the Old Testament was to be deity, the Son of God, and Jesus has claimed that for himself. And so he wants to know, are you the Christ, the Son of God? Well, in verse 64, Jesus says he is. By the statement that he gives, "Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power." Noted last Wednesday evening that the word "the power" is given when it is God who is under consideration. So an attribute of God is mentioned in the place of God. So they'll see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of God and coming on the clouds of heaven. A statement that Jesus had made, and we went and looked back in Matthew chapter 24 last week at the statement that he had made of the same thing, that in the destruction of Jerusalem, they would see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven, and all the tribes of the land would mourn because of what was going to take place in the destruction of Jerusalem and the nation of Israel at that time in 70 A.D. And so because of what Jesus said, and the high priest clearly understood that Jesus was affirming the fact that he was the Christ, the Son of God. How do we know the high priest understood him to claim that? Because of the actions of the high priest. Verse 65, "Then the high priest tore his clothes, saying, 'He has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look now, you have heard his blasphemy.'" They see him as a man who claims to be deity in the flesh, the Son of God. the Messiah. It's clear that the high priest understood that when Jesus said, "It is as you said," that he affirmed that which the high priest said, that he was indeed the Christ, the Son of God. And because of that, the high priest tore his clothes. That was something that was often done, a tearing of clothes. Sometimes at great mourning or lamentation, people would tear their clothes as a sign of mourning or lamentation. People in high positions of authority, when such things as this was done or statements of blasphemy was made, they would tear their clothes or rend their clothes. And so he does that on this occasion. In verse 66, "What do you think?" They answered and said, "He is deserving of death, because he, being a man, claimed to be God in the flesh." And so they think, now, by the very words of Jesus himself, what further need do we have of witnesses? We don't need any witnesses. Jesus has condemned himself with his own mouth. That is, they have all the testimony they need. As a matter of fact, the Sanhedrin Council is made up of 70 plus one. They don't need two witnesses now to claim that he is claimed to be deity in the flesh. All has heard it. And so now they think they have got enough to condemn him to death. He is deserving of death. "Then they spat in his face and beat him, and others struck him with the palms of their hands." They spat in his face. Now, during this particular period of time, that was expected. It was an action to shame one. Today, of course, if you spit in someone's face, you can be held accountable for it. It's many state laws against it as assault. And so, but back there, during this particular period of time, and even after, to spit in someone's face was expected in society, especially if the person was to be shamed or put to shame openly in public. Many people would spit in their face to shame them publicly. And so this was what was being done here, to shame him publicly for what he had done. They spit in his face, a very degrading thing, but nonetheless, that was the custom of this particular period of time, and there was nothing seen to be wrong with it. It was expected when someone was found guilty of a high crime. "So they spat in his face, and they beat him, and others struck him with the palms of their hands, saying, 'Prophesy to us, Christ.'" So he's claimed, now get this, not only the high priest, "Prophesy to us, Christ." He claims to be the Messiah, so he should be able to prophesy. He claims to be deity. He should be able to prophesy. "Who is the one who struck you?" All of this, of course, is done out of mockery, as if he is not the Christ, as if he could not tell them who it was that struck him. He could have if he had wanted to, but of course they were mocking him because he claimed to be the Christ. Now, Peter is introduced here and comes in the middle of this trial of Jesus before the Sanhedrin. Matthew mentions Peter, and later on he'll mention Judas as well, kind of put in connection with the trial of Jesus that's going on with the Sanhedrin Council and later with Pontius Pilate as well. And one would say, well, why does he interject Peter back into it and then interject Judas into it? Perhaps to show a distinction, perhaps, between Peter and Christ's reaction and Peter's reaction, and then Judas's reaction to what had taken place or what was going to continue to take place. And so verse 69 of Matthew 26, "And Peter sat outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him saying, 'You also were with Jesus of Galilee.' But he denied it before them all, saying, 'I do not know what you're saying.'" Now remember, this is in connection with Jesus prophesying earlier about Peter denying him three times before the rooster crows twice. Now remember, the Jews had two crowings of a rooster. That is, the rooster would crow once about 3 o'clock in the morning, and just before sunup, the rooster would crow again. So Peter is going to deny Christ before sunup three times before the rooster crows twice. A time reference, the rooster crowing twice. So he denies him once here, but then he denied it before them all, saying, "I do not know what you're saying." And when he had gone out to the gateway, another girl saw him and said to those who were there, "This fellow also was with Jesus of Nazareth." But again he denied with an oath, "I do not know the man." He denied with an oath. You might say he swore. Swore an oath that he does not know him. "I do not know," and note this man. Not, "I do not know Jesus of Nazareth." He couldn't even bring himself to say his name. "I do not know this man." But again, he denied it with an oath, "I do not know the man." And after a while, those who stood by came to him and said to him, "Surely you also are one of them, because your speech betrays you." After a while. Now, one of the gospel accounts, I forget whether it's Mark, Luke, or John, one of them said it was about an hour since the second question was posed to him. So think about this. When we talk about the time, remember it was late in the night when they arrested him. And Peter is going to deny him three times before the sun comes up, before the rooster crows twice. The rooster crows once again by 3 a.m. in the morning, but between 3 a.m. and sunrise, the rooster's going to crow again. That tells us the time of night when these things are taking place. And because, and I forget which writer mentions it, it was about an hour after he had made the last statement, the second denial, that he makes the third denial. So that tells us about the time frame of the night in which it was. And it will also tell us that when he comes before Pilate, it's already daybreak. So things are transpiring quickly this night. But we also see something take place about people in this time period in regard to their work day and when it began. Can you imagine a governor holding court at daybreak? But that's what we have. That's what we have. We have the Sanhedrin Council here that met all night long in order to condemn Jesus. And the governor, he had no reason to get up earlier other than the whole court. And so people started their days early, very early in the day. Just kind of a side note. So after a while, Matthew's account says, Matthew 26:73, again the other accounts, one of them says after about an hour. "And after a while, those who stood by came to him and said to Peter, 'Surely you also are one of them, because your speech betrays you.'" The other gospel accounts, at least two of them, mention the fact that he was from Galilee or a Galilean. So evidently the Jews who lived in Galilee had a different dialect, or their speech was different than the Jews who lived in Judea. Evidently there was some way, based upon how they spoke, you could tell from what region they were from. Just as I guess you can in the States, if someone's from up north and comes down south and wasn't raised up here and learned the language, or if someone from the south goes to the north, same idea. So they were able to tell that indeed he was a Galilean, and his speech actually betrayed him. Verse 74, "Then he began to curse and swear, saying, 'I do not know the man,' and immediately a rooster crowed." He began to curse and swear. Now, the word curse and swear here does not mean that he was using foul language. Began to curse. Actually, the word curse carries the idea of pronouncing a curse upon himself. That if he was not telling the truth. Something bad would happen to him. And that's brought out more in the word swear here. Swear. The word swear here carries the idea of to anathematize. Now, the word anathema, remember Paul mentions that in the book of Galatians, let you be anathema, that is, dedicated or devoted to destruction. So what Peter is doing here is he's calling for a curse or destruction to come upon him if he's lying. That's what he's doing by cursing and swearing. It's not that he's using profanity, but he's calling for destruction or harm to come upon him if he's telling a lie. Well, certainly it would come upon him if he told a lie. And so that's what's under consideration here. Then he began to curse and to swear, saying, I do not know the man. Again, he says the man instead of Jesus of Nazareth or Jesus Christ. And immediately a rooster crowed. A rooster crowed. And Peter remembered the word of Jesus who had said to him, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. Then he went out and wept bitterly. So, of course, Peter on this occasion comes to himself, I guess, after the rooster crows and recognizes what's taken place. Jesus foretold what was going to happen, and it has happened exactly the way Jesus said. And now he has denied the Christ, even though earlier he was willing to die for him. Even drew his sword and cut off a servant of a high priest ear. He was willing to die, but now he denies him. But of course we know from the teaching of the Scripture that because he wept bitterly, he repented and was remorseful for the sin of denying the Christ. And of course, Jesus had also prophesied as well, when he would return, he would help the others as well in their faith and confidence in Jesus as being the Son of God. Chapter 27 in verse 1. When morning came, all the chief priests and the elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. When morning came. So the rooster crowed. The rooster crowed just before sunup. But when morning came. So it's very early in the morning. As a matter of fact, when we look at the other accounts, by the time they bring Jesus to Pilate, it's just now 6 o'clock in the morning. So when morning came, it's not even 6 o'clock in the morning yet. I think it's John's account that gives the time frame. It's being the 6th hour and being reckoned as Roman time at that particular time period. It would be 6 o'clock in the morning, as the 9th hour would be 9 o'clock. So he doesn't come to Pilate until 6 o'clock in the morning, so when morning came, it's still very early in the morning. The rooster is crowed after Peter has denied the Christ. So when morning came, all the chief priests and the elders of the people, all of them, the Sanhedrin Council, that's what's under consideration, took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. They took counsel, that is, they consulted together. So you might say the trial has been held. But they're going to have to come up with some way by which they can put him to death. Now, according to their law, they could take him out and stone him for blaspheming. A man making himself God. As a matter of fact, remember Jews tried to do that on other occasions as Jesus claimed to be deity in the flesh. They would take up stones to stone him, to put him to death, because the old law would require that. But here, the Sanhedrin Council, of course, they're governed by Roman authority. The Sanhedrin Council does not, even though later on we'll see that the Jews stoned Stephen to death. We wonder how it is, as John tells us in his account, because the Sanhedrin Council, when they go to Pilate, Pilate tells them to take care of it themselves, and they say, well, we don't have the authority to put him to death. We wonder why they don't have the authority to put him to death, but later on in the book of Acts, Stephen is stoned to death. Because sometimes mobs, sometimes people take control of the situation and carry out the stoning without the approval of the Roman authorities. But here, the Sanhedrin Council, because the high priest wants to stay, no doubt, in the good graces of Pontius Pilate, and the other Roman authorities, they will take him to the Roman authorities because they want this to appear legal, although it's not legal in any sense of the word. And the way they've treated Jesus, he is a just man, he has not committed any crime, and Pilate will recognize that in the trial that he has. But they counsel together against Jesus to put him to death. So they're going to have to figure out some way, when they take him before Pontius Pilate, to accuse him of some violation by which Roman law would put him to death. Because Roman law wouldn't put him to death for blaspheming the God of the Jews. Romans wouldn't do that. So they're going to have to come up with something that they can charge him with. And I want to suggest to you that's why they're counseling together. That's why they're consulting with one another, to come up with some way by which they can put him to death. And we'll see what it is they come up with later on. And when they had bound him, they led him away. Now this is the first occasion we read of them binding him. We don't read of them binding him when they first arrested him, although they may have. But now he seems to be condemned, and so they bind him. And when they had bound him, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor. The governor. The prefect. Some versions would call him, instead of the governor, procurator. During this particular period of time, the Romans had different terms by which they called the rulers of the people. Of course, we can relate to governor better than we can to a prefect or a procurator. But Judea was a part of Syria. That is a part of Syrian government rule during this particular period of time. There were senatorial provinces, and then there was imperial provinces. Senatorial provinces were those provinces of Roman land that the senators got to choose who the governors were, or prefects, or procurators were. The imperial provinces, such as Judea, the emperor himself chose the one who was going to be over that province. What was the difference? Well, an imperial province was a province that was not always, you might say, peaceful under Roman rule. They needed Roman troops to keep them under control. Judea was one of those imperial provinces. So Caesar, Tiberius at this time, would have chosen Pontius Pilate for this particular job, so he could keep the Jews under control. And so he's referred to here as the governor. Now Pontius Pilate ruled this region, and he was very ruthless with the Jews. As a matter of fact, Luke records an occasion in which he spilled the blood of many Jews and mingled it even with their sacrifice. So Pontius Pilate didn't really like the Jews at all. He would have destroyed them if he had an opportunity. But he knew that he had to keep them appeased and keep the peace the best he could. If not, he would have to answer to Tiberius. And later on, he did answer to Tiberius because he kind of got out of hand. And he was deposed. And after that, he went and committed suicide in 36 A.D. So he's the governor of this particular province up until 36 A.D. And now, intermingled in this, having taken him to Pontius Pilate before that trial sets out, Matthew records the occasion of Judas now. Judas. Then Judas, his betrayer, seeing that he had been condemned, was remorseful and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priest and the elders. Now, Matthew is perhaps on this occasion not recording this particular section of text in chronological order, because we do not know exactly when it was that Judas brought back the pieces of silver. Was it after the Sanhedrin council condemned him and then took him to Pilate? Or was it after he learned what was going to take place after Pilate had given him up to be crucified? Most likely that was it. Because later on, in one of the other gospel accounts, we read of the high priest being in the temple. And on this occasion, in the reading of this text, Judas throws the money in the temple. But on this occasion as well, the Sanhedrin council are on their way to Pilate with Jesus. And we know, because of the other gospel accounts, that he comes before Pilate on trial at the sixth hour, 6 o'clock in the morning. So from the time the rooster crows to the time Pilate gets him, doesn't leave much time. I doubt if the chief priest would be back in the temple worried about what Judas has to say about the 30 pieces of silver. So Matthew doesn't record this section in chronological order. Perhaps he inserts it here in connection with Peter and in connection with what had been said about Judas previous to this time. Then Judas's betrayer, seeing that he had been condemned, was remorseful and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priest and the elders, saying, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." And they said, "What is that to us? You see to it. I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." Judas recognized and realized that he had sinned because he had betrayed innocent blood. What does that mean, he had betrayed innocent blood? He had betrayed an innocent man. And they were going to shed his blood. They were going to put him to death. That's the ideal of betraying innocent blood. He was a just man. He was an innocent man. But Judas had betrayed him up to the point to where they were going to put him to death, even though he was an innocent man. Now, perhaps Judas might have thought earlier when he made this deal that they might beat Jesus, beat him and let him go. Surely they won't put him to death. Perhaps he didn't think of the consequences of his actions. Perhaps even though he was covetous and wanted the money, perhaps he recognized and realized now that what has taken place was not worth the 30 pieces of silver, having a just or innocent man being put to death. But nonetheless, that's what's going to happen. And they said to him, "What is that to us?" Another way of saying, "We don't care. We don't care about Judas. You see to it. You take care of that matter. You bear the consequence of what's happening. It's your fault." Well, it took two to tangle, and they were as guilty as he was. Verse 5, "Then he threw down the pieces of silver in the temple." The pieces of silver. Now, 30 pieces of silver, we don't know how much that was worth during that particular period of time. As we studied it earlier, we said we could go back in the Old Testament, and just as a coincidence, it was the price of a slave that had been gored by an oxen. So it was the price of a damaged slave. That was coincidence, not necessarily meaning that anything significant in regard to this, but it was 30 pieces of silver, and it was a very insignificant amount. A very insignificant amount. But evidently it was enough to satisfy the greed and covetous nature of Judas at the time. Verse 5, "He threw down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself." Went and hanged himself. Now, the other gospel writers do not talk about this. Luke mentions it in the book of Acts, in Acts chapter 2, when they're replacing Judas, that when he hanged himself, and there's speculation, well, did he hang himself on a tree? Did he hang himself in some way to where the rope broke or the limb broke and he fell and his gut busted open? A lot of speculation, we simply do not know. But he went and took his life because of what he had done. Now, perhaps Matthew records that here in regard to Peter, that is to show a distinction between the two. Peter denies Christ three times. He sins against God And he is remorseful to the point that he repents of his sin and makes himself right with the one whom he sinned against. But Judas does not do that. He threw down the pieces of silver in the temple, departed and went out and hanged himself. Yes, he had regretted what he had done back in verse 3. Then Judas, his betrayer, seeing that he had been condemned, was remorseful. I believe the King James Version says repented. But it's not the same word in the Greek that's often translated repented. Yes, he did have a change of mind. He was remorseful. But the word simply means he regretted what he had done. It's the sorrow of the world that Paul speaks of in 2 Corinthians. He simply regretted what he had done and the consequences that came about. But he didn't go about to correct what he had done. Oh, he went to the chief priest and the Sanhedrin council and tried to give the money back. But he went to the wrong ones. He went to the wrong ones. He should have went to the Lord. He should have repented. He would have saved his soul. Instead, he simply regrets his actions and the consequences that came from those actions, and he hanged himself because of it.
In Zechariah chapter 11, verse 12, I think it's one of the most amazing prophecies. It even said the 30 pieces of silver, and it even said that he cast it back into the temple. All of this is just in detail what would happen to Jesus, and he didn't mention his name, but we know it's Judas. Yeah. And all this was prophesied, I guess, at least 500 or 600 years before.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And so, verse 6 of Matthew 27, but the chief priest took the silver pieces and said, it is not lawful to put them in the treasury because they are the price of blood. It's not lawful. They're concerned about something being lawful now. They're concerned about defiling the temple treasury with blood money after they've condemned an innocent man to death. After they counseled with Judas to betray him up to them, after they paid, after they were participants in it, and they're concerned about something being lawful. They don't want to defile the temple treasury by putting blood money in it. The price of blood. What does it mean, the price of blood? Blood represents life. It's the price of life. Taking the life. Oftentimes, blood has reference to the life. When Jesus gave his blood for us, he gave his life for us. The shedding of blood, life is in the blood, the Old Testament scriptures teach us. And so when one gives his blood, he gives his life. Jesus gave his blood, he gave his life for us. And that was the price of blood. That was the price of a man's life. And so it would defile the temple if they put it into the temple treasury. So they took counsel and bought with them the potter's field to bury strangers in. Therefore, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. To this day simply means to the time that Matthew recorded this gospel account. So from the time that it was done up to the time that Matthew, and we don't know exactly when he recorded, perhaps sometime in the 50s perhaps, when he wrote his gospel account, up to that period of time it was known as the field of blood. But note, they bought with them, that is the 30 pieces of silver, the potter's field. The potter's field. What's a potter's field? Does anyone know?
People that couldn't pay for a place to be buried.
People that couldn't pay for a place to be buried. That's how we term the potter's field. We term a field today, a graveyard where people can't afford to be buried. That's where people are buried. We call it a potter's field. We got that idea from the scripture. But the potter's field that was actually purchased, and this goes back to Jeremiah, and Jeremiah is going to be mentioned here in just a moment. Jeremiah purchased a potter's field on one occasion. And so a potter's field, they purchased the potter's field. A potter's field was a place where one who made pottery got his clay from. And so, you know, if someone was in that particular business, they would purchase a field that was an idea for the clay, dirt, in that field to make pots with. And so they would purchase that field, and after a period of time, all the ground would be dug up that was useful for pottery making. Just like if you have maybe a road that needs to be paved, maybe the state will come in and pave the road, but they're going to have to find a sand pit or a gravel pit somewhere. So they go out testing the soil and they find a sandy area over here. So the state buys that piece of land, and then they dig all the sand out of it they want, leave a big hole in the ground. Well, that's the potter's field. The pottery maker buys the field. He uses up the field. He uses all the clay in the field that's useful. And after that, well, what's the field good for? They took the 30 pieces of silver and they bought the potter's field. That's what's under consideration. It was no longer useful for making pottery. If it had, they'd probably sold it for a greater price than 30 pieces of silver. And so that's the potter's field under consideration. And we today still talk about people being buried in the potter's field. That is, they do not have the finances to have a burial, and so the government will bury them in some field that they have purchased or some graveyard that they have purchased. Here it says, the potter's field to bury strangers in. You know, during the feast periods in Jerusalem every year, people would come from all over the known world, that is, Jews would. Some would die while they were there. Without relatives, without anybody to care for them or bury them. And so they would have to be buried somewhere, and they would be buried in the potter's field. That's the strangers under consideration. Therefore, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet. And they took the 30 pieces of silver, the value of him who was priced, whom they of the children of Israel priced, and gave them for the potter's field as the Lord directed me. And Brother Pike mentioned this a few moments ago in Zechariah. But look, Matthew mentions Jeremiah. Well, Jeremiah also talks about the purchase of a potter's field as well. But here's the thing. When he says, Jeremiah, this was fulfilled what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, not written by Jeremiah the prophet. So some suppose, well, you see, the scripture's in error here. It says Jeremiah when it should say Zechariah. No, it says Jeremiah. And I'm persuaded that Matthew, directed by the Holy Spirit, knew exactly who he wanted to mention. He mentioned Jeremiah. Jeremiah spoke of this. Doesn't mean that Jeremiah wrote this, but Jeremiah spoke of this. Now, Jeremiah and Zechariah wrote about the same time period. Remember, Jeremiah is in Jerusalem. Zechariah is in Babylon. So, there's nothing wrong with Jeremiah having spoken that by inspiration of the Holy Spirit. Matthew said he did. And so we just simply need to take the word as it is given. Jeremiah spoke about this. We don't need to say, well, no, there's a mistake there and Zechariah is supposed to be under consideration. No, Jeremiah spoke of this. He may have spoken of it and he may not have written the same thing, but Zechariah did write of it. Perhaps Zechariah may have written of it, and then Jeremiah spoke about that which Zechariah had written. All right, we're out of time. Questions or comments? All right, we'll pick up at verse 11, Matthew 27, verse 11, next Wednesday evening. Thank you very much for your kind attention.